Everybody ready? Great. Thank you, Michael. Good morning, colleagues. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways comment. And Means Subcommittee on Education for Wednesday, May 3rd, 2017. Today we are having an informational hearing on our English Language Learners Program, put on primarily or perhaps entirely by the Oregon Department of Education. So, Dr. Noor, if you'd like to come up, I don't know if you'd like Dawn and Cindy to come with you now.
Sure.
After? Great.
And Dawn, why don't you you'll be doing most of the presenting, so why don't you sit here?
Michael, I'm having trouble loading it. I come up with an error. I'm not sure if other people, other folks are too.
I cheated and printed it today. This is off subject, dear to me.
I don't even.
Still error. Well, please go ahead.
It's up on the screen.
I'm happy. So. I was going to say. Look at it on the screen.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith, Warner, Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Oregon Department of Education. And we appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today and share some information with you regarding our English language learners programs and services. We have three programs that we're going to share with you today, and I hesitantly call them programs. I would suggest that they are strategies that we're trying to combine into a single program. And the strategies consist of our statewide English language learners plan that was developed in 2013, and we're continuing to refine and implement that plan. We have that plan sets directions, priorities, and goals that are based on practitioners from the fields. We have our Title III, which is a federal program that provides supports and services as well as funding to English language learners in our schools and districts throughout the state. And then we have the wonderful and enormous state investment in House Bill 3499 that is also referred to as our English Learners Plan. And that plan provides targeted supports and interventions, including accountability for districts to improve outcomes for English learners. So what I want to underscore before I turn it over to my colleagues to give you the details of each of these plans is that under the Every Student Succeeds Act, we have an opportunity to consolidate all of those plans into a single coherent state plan that serves our English learners in the state of Oregon. Most importantly, what we're interested in is building capacity in districts throughout the state to be able to shore up their services and sustain and maintain those services over time to help students be successful. So the goal is to bring these three strategies together into a coherent state plan that focuses on leveraging resources, aligning, I forgot my glasses. Yeah. Aligning programs and elements, including accountability and ensuring coherence regarding the supports and services that we provide for students, and to maintain that in a systematic way. So instead of piecemealing it and instead of just relying on one strategy or another that may appear to be conflicting or competing with each other, we really want to have a coherent plan that identifies students, identifies the best practices that we can use to serve those students and to sustain that over time. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues to share with you the key components of each one of those strategies.
Thank you, Salam. My name is Cindy Hunt, the Government and Legal Affairs Manager at the Department. It's my pleasure to be here today after sitting in the back for a couple of weeks, but engaged and watching. So today, like Dr. Noor said, we're going to go over a broad overview of our EL students in Oregon and then each of those three strategies that he referenced in his opening remarks. So for our broad overview, one of the things that you're going to hear when we start talking about these programs is different terminology. And you may have heard this in prior presentations, so I thought it would be a good idea just to kind of go over this. So you'll hear English as a second language is the oldest of our terms, or you might hear that referred to as ESL. You might have even heard it referred to as the ESL weight in the state school fund, because that's what it was until 2015. That term is no longer really used because, you know, when you start talking to some of our English learners in Oregon, English isn't their second language. It's their third, their fourth, their fifth, right? We also will see the term English Language Learner, or ELL, and that was used in 3499, and that's used quite a bit, you know, throughout our programs. You also see the term Limited English Proficiency, or LEP. That's a federal term and in federal law. And then finally, English learners, or EL, it's also federal programs. It's one of the terms that we're using as the most prevalent today. So no matter what term we use, it all means the same, basically the same thing. And so this is our standard definition of an English language learner. This particular definition actually came from our work in 3499.
Representative Wisnant.
Okay, I should have probably let you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy. So this definition came out of 3499?
Yeah. So
you're going to talk about testing for this early in part of the presentation?
Yeah. So Thank Chair you. Smith-Warner and Representative Wisnant, this definition came out of 3499, but it's also very consistent with federal programs and also was incorporated into the state school fund. So you might see slight differences between it and some of our federal definitions that we work under, but this is our basic definition that we operate under in our programs. And so when we talk about English language learners, for example, it's a student who has limited English language proficiency because English is not their native language, or the student comes from an environment where a language other than English has had a significant impact on the student's level of English language proficiency. So this is the kids that we are talking about today. Okay. The other terms that you'll see, though, there's a few others. So we have this term EVER-EL. So when I first heard this, I was like, what is that? Right? So it's all of these types of students that you see up there. So current, monitored, and former or exited. Basically, what it means is that a current EL or a current English learner is a student who's currently receiving English learner services. Monitored EL, that is a term in the federal law again. So these are students that have exited EL, but we are still required to collect data on them and monitor their progress for 4 years after they've exited. And then we have a term, former or exited, which means they're no longer receiving necessarily EL services. All of these together are ever ELs. And so when we go to look at the data, sometimes you'll see data that says these are English language learners or current English language learners. Those are students currently receiving services. Or sometimes you'll see, you know, this is data based on ever ELs or former ELs. Those are students who received EL services at some point in their K-12 career. Okay? And when we present data, we try to distinguish between those. So those are as our basic terminology that you're going to see in data and hear at the points in the presentation. But it also illustrates some of the challenges, because as we start to merge state EL with federal EL, you know, sometimes, you know, we try to make it match completely, right? But sometimes there's just a few little differences, right, that we're talking about.
Are there any state requirements about monitoring after, or is that only a federal requirement?
Chair Smith-Warner, that is only a federal requirement, but I'm going to put a big asterisk next to that, because after 3499, we do have a general state reporting requirement, and as part of that state report, we do include data on students who were our ever EL or former EL category, and so that is definitely included in that report. And at the very end of this presentation, I have a link to our last annual report, and if you were to click into that, you would definitely see data on those students.
Okay. And I would assume, just briefly, two things. Number one, that you track that in the longitudinal data system, a student's at some point EL participation. That would be something that you track in the longitudinal data?
Chair Smith-Warner, when we look at general achievement data for students in Oregon, you will often see it broken up into student groups, for example, and EL students are one of those student groups that are highlighted. And so, therefore, I believe in the longitudinal data system would also be included.
Okay, great. And I guess when I see that ever, one thing that you just said to me, it's not forever. You're not forever in EL. It's if you were ever in EL.
Exactly, so. Exactly. And, yeah. Okay, right. So here's our three programs that Dr. Knorr sort of briefly touched upon in his opening remarks that we're going to be talking about and going into a little more depth today. The first of these is what we call Title III, and that's our federal program around English language acquisition. And under that program, the department's provided funds from the U.S. Department of Education that we then send out to school districts. The second program is what we call the 0.5 ELL rate in the state school fund. And school districts receive this money based on their EL population specifically. And then finally, English language learner grants, which is, this is the HB 3499 work. And 3499 is a piece of legislation that was adopted in 2015 by this legislature. Okay. So monetarily, how these break down.
I'm sorry, Cindy, just a quick, could you go back briefly to that last slide? So am I assuming correctly that the same numbers, you would get the same numbers for the federal funds number as well as the state school fund? You count the same way
the next
for the feds and the...
Here's
the... Okay, sorry.
Chair Smith Warner.
Not dollar amount necessarily, but I guess I just mean head count. I just wanted to confirm that you use the same head count for both.
Chair Smith Warner, we do, however, however, with the data that we report, sometimes the data is such that when you see it on the slide, for example, our most recent data is from the 14-15 school year for purposes of federal reporting. But when we look at some of our state school fund numbers that you're going to see, that is our estimates going into 17-18.
Okay.
So we're kind of talking about the same kids, but sometimes we're looking at a different year for those kids. So that's where you sometimes will see, you know, some variation. And then also, you know, and on a highly kind of technical level, the federal law has a specific definition, a very specific, you know, way of identifying students, right? Whereas the state school fund and HB 3499 has our state definition, those align, but technically they're two different laws.
Right. But the number, would you agree that you would still count every all the same kids?
Yes.
Great. Okay. Representative Wisnett, did you have a...
I didn't think, thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy, I didn't think that's exactly true. I didn't think that what she's asking is the number of the of state school students for $384 million. They get $14 million. I thought it was a different number from the schools, and some schools don't get do the Title III reporting or something. Is that not true?
Yeah, Chair Smith Warner, Representative Wisnett, thank you for that clarification. So across Oregon, and we'll get into this a little bit in some of our slides. So it's the same kids who would qualify a school district, but there are some districts, between 20 to 25 districts, who choose to decline EL funds each year for various reasons.
Okay? Including reporting.
And they're declining federal funds specifically, not necessarily state funds. Okay. So that's also a reason why you can see some variation in these numbers. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. That all helps.
Yeah. So this slide shows the actual money that goes into these programs. And so for a Title III, the federal program, so in 15-17, it was $14.2 million. And then for 17-19, we expect that to increase to $15.7 million. The state school fund was at $384.8 million. Our most recent estimates would have this at $400.2 million. And to be clear, this $400.2 million figure is only the money attributed to the EL weight. It is not the money attributed to the first 1.0 ADM that the child, that the school district would also get for the child.
Additional.
It also, we have many EL students that are dual identified as EL and special education, or EL and in poverty, and some of those other weights that we've talked about with the state school fund. So this is specific to the EL weight. And then finally, we have our 3499 money, and that was $9.9 million that we spent on the program in 15-17, and then that's increasing to 12.5. The reason for that variation is that the districts that were named under 3499 as in improvement or our target and transformation districts, those were named a year into the biennium. So next year, they will, or next biennium, they'll be named for 2 years. So that's the main reason for that increase. I must point out, though, because we were eager to give you the most up-to-date numbers, so the $462 million, if you were to do quick math, it actually adds up to $428.4 million. And the reason for that is our state school fund number up there is the most accurate possible, and that's what's changed. So really, the state school fund represents about 5% of the total.
Okay.
and we can provide you the up-to-date numbers and correct the slide. I wanted to point that out. So what this shows is that the bulk of the money that school districts receive for EL students is by far the state school fund. So this shows the actual count of EL students in Oregon. And these are those current students who are receiving EL services. This data was taken as part of our federal monitoring that I mentioned. And you'll see that for the last couple of years, our EL population in Oregon has maintained pretty steady around that 57,000 mark. We anticipate that that will hold steady going into 16-17 as well. This slide, though, shows you, okay, so this is the top 10 languages that are spoken by our EL students. And so what you see there is by far Spanish is the most prevalent language. And so regarding the percent of students in the far right column that says limited English proficiency, remember that's a term used in the federal law. So of our EL students, about 76% are Spanish speaking, but there's 9 other languages in the top 10 that are also spoken in Oregon. So you'll see Russian, Vietnamese, Chinese, Arabic with their percentages going down. And so this gives you a sense of, you know, sort of the languages spoken in Oregon. But the next two slides, I think, are also interesting. There's a bunch of other languages as well. And so for many of our school districts, you know, they have more than 20, more than 30, you know, languages being spoken. At one point, Portland was reporting more than 90 languages being spoken within its schools. And the next slide also shows the languages. Yeah.
Real quick question.
Yep. Representative Wisnett.
Real quick. Cindy, is Russian, are you including Serbian, Croatia, and all those? Because I would think they would have made the, at least Serbian, would have made the top 10.
So Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett, I'm not sure. I'll have to get back to you on that. I'm not sure what is included in the Russian category specifically.
Thank you.
Representative Lively.
Thank you. And so just so I understand this, so the money we talked about, the additional money being available for these English language learners, is not specific to Spanish, or that it's just specific they've been identified, and then within those districts, they have to decide how to apply it to cover the most students.
So Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Lively, so the way that a student, I'm going to draw you back to the way that the student qualifies, is that, you know, their home language is other than English. So it's not necessarily Spanish. It could be any of these languages that was up on these screens, right? So, but the expectation, I want to be really clear about this, the expectation on the district is to serve all students. It doesn't matter the language that they come into school with. And so so that is something that our districts definitely struggle with is, you know, the more home languages that a district has, that presents some different struggles.
Sure. Thank you.
And challenges. Languages there. Okay. So what this slide shows is exactly where our ELs are in Oregon. And so as you look at this slide, the gray represents in our last reporting, and so this represents the year 2015 to 16. Mm-hmm. And so the gray, there were no EL students reported. Okay. And this is according to our federal data collection. And then as you kind of move through the map, the dark red has, you know, 1 to 29 EL students, with the dark green being 2,500 plus in EL students. So what this shows us is that EL students are distributed throughout the state, but there are different numbers of kids, you know, as you go throughout the state and school districts. The other thing, you know, to keep in mind that this map isn't necessarily showing you is the percentage of EL students in each district.
I was just going to ask that.
If you could
do this in a as a percentage.
Yeah, well, Chair Smith-Warner, we made note of that. And, I mean, because I think you heard testimony from a high school principal yesterday, which talked about the large percentage of EL students, you know, within his high school, and he was representing the Umatilla School District, which is one of our highest percentages districts in the state. I can't remember off the top of my head the high, you know, but they're definitely in the top 10. Okay. And so, you know, so that percentage also matters. It's not just the sheer numbers.
And can I confirm the gray... The gray districts that report none federally, and I noted that you said that, and you had also said earlier that there are districts who may report none or who may not accept the federal money. Does this also mean, might there be some of those grays that they have EL students, but they don't accept the federal money, or that they actually do not have?
Chair Smith Warner, I believe that's the case. They may have them, but they don't. Except, okay. Right? But we also have districts, just to be clear up there, that for 15-16, they truly have no EL students, right? Because as we were looking at, you know, the federal data and the state data and so forth, there are definitely districts where you'll have very few EL students kind of coming and going from the district.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisdom.
Cindy, what's the book, the federal book is about how thick on how to report? I've looked at it.
Yes. Chair Smith Warner, Representative Wisnett, yes, the federal regulations in this area are quite daunting. Yes, that's true. Okay, so with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Don Huckabee, to talk in more depth about Title III, our federal program.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Don Huckabee. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Teaching, Learning, and Assessment. And so it's my pleasure to share some information with you about the federal side of our English learners and the resources that go to our school district to support them. So English learner acquisition is under our federal program called Title III. It also includes some resources for our immigrant youth as well. These federal funds are designed to provide supports for our students who have that limited English proficiency. So again, that other term, for our children and youth who are really, who need some support in learning English, and so that they are able to learn English and then be able to be successful in our challenging state academic content and achievement standards. These funds are distributed through a formula out to our districts, and we serve approximately 57,000 students with these Title III resources. The schools use those resources. As a former director in a school district where I did oversee the English learner programs, we use these funds to support the instructional program. So we hire teachers. Our districts hire teachers. They hire instructional assistants. They use them to use for supplemental materials to be able to help students learn English, and then also providing some of that academic content support that they need. And we do measure these through achievement objectives through our English language proficiency assessment. So I think Representative Wisnett was asking around that. Every student who is identified for English language services, even if they do decline, even if a parent declines the services, we still must assess them. And so we are assessing their English progress from the time they're in kindergarten until in kindergarten through 12th grade, as long as they are currently being served or eligible to be served.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So they're distributed by formula. I assume this is a different, this is not the like the formula we use at the state where we have a percentage, but so is the formula based on percent of students in the district? I'm trying to understand what that allocates.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Representative Lively. We do have, the federal government gives us a formula that we are to use. It takes a look at, yes, the number of students that are in, and so obviously the districts that have a higher percentage or more students will get a larger piece of the resource than smaller districts. Thank you for the question. This slide gives you a sense of, and this is 2015-16 data, of the number of English learners that are in each grade level. And so I really want to draw your attention to where our largest numbers are. And you'll see there are kindergarten, first, and second grade students. So of those 57,000, almost 24,000 of them are in kindergarten, first, and second grade. So we tend to see a lot of our newcomer students come in at those very young ages. You'll also notice that when you get down into those high school levels, especially if you look at the number that have been identified for 0 to 2 years, when our students come into high school in grades 9 through 12, those are students who are really coming in as high school students and are English learners. So they've not been in the country very long. And so also thinking about getting them to graduation requirements, extensive work to help those students. And you also then see the next column is, so how many of those students have been identified for 3 to 6 years, and then how many have been identified for 7 or more. And so you can see across the grade levels, again, everything up through sixth grade are significant population. And then you can just see how those extrapolate out from a percentage standpoint. And so we really start to see, we know that the best success is if we can exit them within 5 years, and you'll see our rates when we get them as kindergartners and extending out, that we don't see a whole lot of them. We see many of them exiting before they hit sixth grade.
Can I ask about that, though? I think this is what even I think anybody who even has kind of a cursory thought about how it works, the theory is always the more quickly, the younger they are, the more quickly they learn, the more fully you immerse them in it, the more, you know, the more quickly they will get to a level of proficiency where they will then get out and have greater success rates. And I've always been struck by the numbers that indeed kids who have exited out of English Learner have, I think, higher graduation rates and better success rates.
That is correct.
So I think that is such a strong testament to how important both these programs are and getting them out of these programs are. So I guess I just wanted to touch on, so looking across to that, as you go down the grade levels, I guess my bigger concern is that, so for grade 7, 60% of those kids have been in for 7 years or more. That is how I read that. Maybe the numbers are in the wrong things, or maybe that's like a cumulative number, because I would find that very troubling if 60% of seventh graders who are in EL programs are still there after 7 years, because that would mean they started early and they're not succeeding and exiting out.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, you're absolutely right in looking at that data, and I was not the person who pulled that data together. So, but it does strike me as well as being seeming a little bit of an anomaly. Both at seventh grade and eighth grade.
Right.
So we'll need to get back to you and double check.
Okay,
on those
great.
Numbers.
Yeah, because I know, and Representative and I were just briefly talking about this, because that is the concern: is the disincentive that districts have for getting kids successfully out of this because they get extra weights, and you can of course understand it. Mm-hmm. In an always resource-starved environment, you want to hang on to all the resources that you have. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, though, getting those kids out is the best way for them to have success.
Yes.
Madam Co-Chair, if I may just add to that. So I think the number, when you look at that percentage in particular, it does not necessarily represent all of the grades that preceded seventh mm-hmm. grade. So we may actually have some newcomers arriving in the United States. That may include a migrant population also that's fairly fluid in its movement around the state and the country. So that number is not necessarily just the preceding grades. It could have newcomers. And we experienced this in the Salem-Keizer School District, and we had a newcomer center in one of our middle schools, and we saw a surge in the number of middle school students that arrived that needed some language development skills. The other thing that I would add is that the fact that we're able to identify students in these categories is a dramatic improvement from an accountability point of view, because now we're able to pinpoint specifically the number of years that a student has been in a program, and we're able to track their progress over time. In the past, I will tell you that we had students that have been in the program for 11, 12 years, and we were not able to account to their progress. So we've made a dramatic improvements in the way we organize, in the way we identify the students, identify their language learning needs, and track their progress over a number of years. And the path to proficiency, if you will, I think we're considering 7 years, right, to exit a student from a program. So it's just what I want to underscore is that students enter into that definition at different times, mm-hmm. and some may be new seventh graders that have just arrived, and that's why they're in that category, because we assume that for 7 years they've been in a program and they're still in the program, but in actuality in Oregon they may have been in a program for 1 or 2 or 3 years.
Okay. I would be concerned about those, honestly, about those people being in that category, because mm-hmm. that's therefore not getting you the information that you really want. And also, well, and 7 years is just striking for me because, again, if you have somebody who starts at kindergarten, you sure would want them out by seventh grade if they had been doing that. If not, I would say maybe by second or third.
Right.
Not that I'm any sort of practitioner.
Yep. No, that's correct.
But
and And Madam Co-Chair, the trend that we're seeing, especially for elementary students, is that they do actually get exited by the time they get into sixth and seventh grades.
Okay.
So the ones that truly start in the program from kindergarten on, and they're receiving instruction for 5 or 6 years, that's when we tend to see them exit it. And that's why you see the numbers drop significantly at the high school level. But at the middle school level, it is a bit deceiving because you have a lot of newcomers that enter
this,
at the same
this
time.
This whole slide, yeah. when you go from 8 to 180 to 70, I mean, there's a lot of questions. And Madam Chair, thank you. And I thought that was the original part of 3499 was we were going to limit so school districts wouldn't be doing unethical things, that 7 years was going to be the max that you could be in a program or get funding for it. I'm not sure we actually have.
So, Chair Smith Warner, Representative Wisnett, within 3499, there was a direction to identify best practices around what 3499 defined as long-term ELs. That's not a term, though, that you hear out in the field. So then we did define it as 7 years, and then talked about what are best practices relating to students who have been identified as EL for 5, 6, 7 years, right? As part of that work, though, in the work group, I know some of our practitioners would tell you it kind of depends on the kid, what are the best practices, right? And I think that Dr. Noor and Don have talked about that a little bit already. But we also know that, for example, in some of our dual language programs, which are not specifically Yale programs, but a lot of Yale students are in our dual language programs. In some of those programs, what you'll see is students' achievement with language proficiency will be kind of like this, and then it'll shoot out like in the fifth, the sixth, the seventh year. So you kind of have to look at the data kind of differently depending on the program.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
I'm more confused now than I was, but here's the point I'm not getting. So if I look at this chart and I go down to a seventh grade and the number of ELs identifies 7 or more years, and it shows seventh grade 1,721 and then eighth grade 1,127. So I'm trying to, because it says identified 7 or more years, but I'm trying to understand, I appreciate people move in that, but I'm trying to, the term identified, it means to me that we've known, somebody's known since kindergarten that they were EL students. And so I'm trying to understand if somebody has known that, how we end up with that number jumping so much still in the seventh grade if they've been identified all those years. I guess that's, I'm just not making the connections.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Representative Lively. I believe, and I would need to double check the data, I believe that some of these, I mean, yes, you're right, they've been identified, and I think as Dr. Noor was alluding to, some of these students, especially in our middle schools, is they go in and out of the country sometimes, and so while they've been identified, they may not have been in a program consistently for 7 straight years. That would be one example. I don't know why those numbers are that high, because we might not see that in some of the other grade levels, but that is some of the trends that we see there.
Madam Chair, why don't we have the department go back and take a look at these numbers and then maybe talk to the experts to see about that. We'll have them either come back or maybe write up in a memo form the explanations, since we're sort of spinning.
Yeah, we're turning a little bit. So go ahead. Oh, Representative Parrish.
So I've got a question, because I've sat through lots of ELL hearings, and one of the things that I have not heard is sort of the mechanism of delivery of the EOL programming. I mean, are we pulling kids out of classrooms to support them with language? And if that's really happening, is that causing the challenge where kids maybe aren't acquiring English the way they should be? I mean, I have a lot of people in my family who came to this country and didn't speak any English, and the fastest way they learned it was being thrown into work situations or school situations. I have cousins who came over from the Middle East as teenagers and never spoke a word of English and got here and got thrown into school. We didn't have fancy ELL programs back in the day, and they acquired the English language very quickly from what is arguably a very difficult language that has no connection to the English language at all. So I'm curious if we're pulling kids out, is that really the way kids are going to acquire language, and is it taking us longer because maybe we're not connecting kids in their classrooms? And I kind of liken this to pulling out kids with disabilities, and we've worked really hard to mainstream kids. missing something?
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Representative Parrish, there are multiple models that districts use. So some do use an immersion program where students are immersed and they get their supports directly in their classrooms. Others are pull-out models where they are getting an amount of time where they're working on specific English language skills, and then they're back in their classroom most of the day. So those are kind of the two models, and it just depends on what each district's English learner plan looks like as to how they're delivering the instruction for students. Please.
Do we have data on which children who've attended which programs are more successful quicker?
Representative Smith Warner and Representative Parrish, probably, but I will have to go back to our program experts to see. I'm not sure. Again, students move in and out of districts and programs. We know what programs each district has. And tracking then a student's attendance through, I mean, that would be a pretty extensive look for us to do, but it's certainly something we could look at.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, I think the trend is to see less and less of pullouts. In extreme circumstances where students, let's say, are newcomers to the United States, students that are refugees that have lived in a refugee camp for the last 2 or 3 years and have had no formal instruction, schools, I think, would find it appropriate to pull out a student and provide them some intensive language development training and skills. But for the most part, I would suggest that we're seeing less and less of that practice, and we're seeing districts adopt models where there is immersion, dual language, blended instruction in terms of the native language and English. And we're seeing at the secondary level in particular what's often called sheltered instruction, where English and Spanish or English and a native language are taught together. The idea here is to get students to academic English. So most of these students, and I think some of you alluded to this, is that Co-Chair Smith Warner, you alluded to it, that many of those students are actually born here. Many of these students are exposed to English at an early stage in their development. So they have some basic skills. The goal is to get them to academic English so they can navigate complex academic content in the subject areas. So many schools are reverting to more of a comprehensive approach, side-by-side English and Spanish, if you will, and the sheltered instruction where they're actually receiving science instruction, social studies, other subjects in the native language. And we're seeing advanced Spanish courses in particular in many of our high schools, including AP Spanish. So I think schools are adapting their strategies in terms of how to deliver instruction, but I think it also depends on the individual student, their circumstances, and their needs. So.
Okay, to give you a little bit more background around what's required in the federal programs, when a student exits from the English Learner Program, as Cindy mentioned earlier, we are required to monitor their status for the next 4 years. This is actually new. Prior to ESSA, it was a 2-year monitoring period. Now ESSA requires us to monitor for 4 years. So again, making sure that students, once they've exited based on proficiency criteria, then we are monitoring their progress. And so if at any point a team, and it's a team that does that monitoring, sees that students are struggling in that core academic area or in their language, continued development of their language, then they can receive supports again. We don't see a whole lot of students that once they're exited that go back from a monitor status back into the program, but there is a rare occasion where that does happen.
And does the monitoring just mean literally like kind of tracking what grades they're getting and making sure they're not failing?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, primarily yes. So it's really looking as a data team that looks at their data. They talk to teachers, making sure that the students are performing and continuing to be successful. Yes.
Thank you.
Districts, for these monitored or former ELs, they do not receive Title III funds for them, nor do they receive the state weighted school fund for those students. Typically, as we typically see most of our EL students exiting grades 4, 5, or 6, and so when we exit them at those grade levels, the monitoring really falls on the middle school and the high school level, and there's no extra resource for that. It's still required that the schools and districts do track those students and ensure that they're being successful. For federal reporting, there's been a shift here with ESSA, with the Every Student Succeeds Act. Prior to ESSA, the Title III monitoring was done separately, and so we were looking at the annual measurable academic objectives, and now those are rolled into what we'll do for accountability for all schools. But what we're really looking at there is it still will be a measure of the number and percentage of our English learners who are making progress towards that English proficiency. So again, those would be those current English learners. Those that have, what percentage and number are obtaining English proficiency. So we're looking at growth in the first one. We're looking at then the actual number that obtain the English proficiency at in the current school year. And then we'd be looking at also the percentage that have not yet obtained English proficiency within 5 years. So again, getting at that measure of how many are taking longer than 5 years. We must report in all of our accountability measures beyond just English learners, but for our academic, our graduation rates, et cetera, we must report the number of ELs in number and percentage of ELs and their proficiency in the core academic areas as well. And then where we can, with English learners who also might be dual identified as perhaps having a disability or any other group that we might determine. But primarily that's the largest group where we would have enough data to be able to do that. As I just mentioned, that our EL progress moves from Title III to Title I in ESSA, and we must include all of the student groups in the measures. We receive around $7 million in an allocation annually from the federal government. 95% of that allocation must be given out to our school districts or education service districts. In some cases, our districts don't have enough English learners to generate enough resource for their own funds, so they must form a consortia. And so in that, to be able to access the resources. And so sometimes it's an ESD that will act as the lead for the consortia of those smaller, those districts that have a small number of English learners. And then 5% of the allocation is what the state may use for administrative supports and for able to provide statewide support for districts.
Here. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Could you give me some data on that, how many school districts, how what they're doing, their ESDs are doing that, please? So, not today, but.
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith-Warner.
How many of them are in the consortium?
Yeah.
Yes, we can give you that data specifically. Actually, our next slide, it's nearly half of our districts. So 127 districts participate in Title III. No. And so nearly half of those participate in a consortium.
Sure. No, what I'm asking, you said some schools, because of the small number, are using ESDs to provide this service. I would like to know more about that. Thinking outside the box and experiencing pulling out of students, I went to a first grade class doing that. That's not effective. It's not effective. And so I'm interested in thinking outside the boxes, but ESDs, if the numbers would work, that and how that program works. Thank you.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett, the ESDs many times act as the fiscal agent. The actual delivery of the services tends to be by the school district staff, but we can certainly get more information for you specifically to how those ESD consortia work.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. As I was mentioning, these districts receive a minimum grant, and we have 20 to 25 districts, depending on the school year, that do choose to decline Title III funds, even though they would be eligible for those resources. And so here's a map that gives you an indication of which districts are funded through Title III and which three either are not funded because they don't have English learners or have declined the funds.
I would love to see a version of that has a different color for the declines, and the versus the just don't have any, don't, whatever.
Okay.
Thank you.
And the last piece here is that Title III, because it's a federal program, we do have the funds can only be used to supplement other resources and not supplant. And they must be supplemental to all federal, local, and state. So even in districts that have Title I resources, there are restrictions on even how they can use their Title III and their Title I together. Mm-hmm. And so Title III can't supplant what's happening in Title I for these students. So it gets very very tricky for districts in making sure that they are supplementing and not supplementing.
And then how is this going to be impacted by the fact that this is moving from Title III to Title I?
It's still Representative Smith-Warner, they're still a federal program. They still are housed as a separate Title III resources from Title I. It's in the Title I accountability model is where the Title III is now lives.
Which is more restrictive, mm-hmm. more accountable. That was good.
So now we are returning to Oregon, so to speak. And so this next section of our presentation is about the state school fund. So we're going to touch on this kind of briefly because I know that you had an in-depth presentation on the state school fund earlier this year. But so under our state school funding formula, there's a 0.5 weight that if a district has an English language learner that is receiving services, that district will receive a 0.5 weight that's in addition to the one that they would get in their ADM. For 17-18, the average ADM of EL students in Oregon was a bit over 50,000. And so that was one of those examples where I said, you know, the numbers will be slightly different because this isn't federal monitoring per se. This is our most recent data, okay? And then, so the additional membership weight will provide an estimated $193 million in 17-18 for about 135 school districts in Oregon. And then this last point is important to understand because, remember, this is the bulk of our money that school districts get for their EL students. But they're not required to spend the money on EL students. So as part of 3499 also required increased levels of budget transparency and accountability. So school districts are now required specifically to tell us how are they spending this money. So we think that this data is going to become more accurate as that rolls out. But I do have some information from 2014-15. On average, 86% of the revenues received from the EL weight was expended on EL students by school districts. Now, that only tells part of the story. And this information is from our report, again, that I have the link in the presentation. When you look at that, though, there's a wide range in there, too. We have several districts that are spending more than 100% on their EL students that they receive from the state school fund. But like I said, as 3499, because when they were reporting for 1415, of course, 3499 had not passed yet. So we believe that as with each coming year, this data will get more and more accurate. And our next annual report will be coming out this summer. So we're a couple of months out from that.
And that'll be for 1516?
Exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. And for the committee. We started looking at this, Representative Gygas and I, several years ago. We get the chart, and the chart just says how much you've spent. And there were school districts were doing this report and putting 10% or 5%. That's what they're saying. That's what they're reporting to the state that we're spending on these students. Mm-hmm. And that's what got our attention, saying this is not right. They're not reporting, and some states came back, school districts came back and corrected their data, but I don't know if they did that with a pencil or they did that with class time. So, real problem, and don't have to say what you're doing, but that's where 3499 hopefully will put some more outcomes. We're looking at outcomes and how you got there. You know, here's the money, okay, but what did you use to get to the outcomes that we want? So hopefully it'll be better. But it's been a real problem. That one-year report, the ODE staff, we looked at it. I think Medford was spending nothing almost on their programs, what they're reporting. Oh, it was a mistake.
Yeah. Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett, that annual report I've referenced, I chose to talk about the average. But if you were to go into that report, it breaks it down by district. So one of the intents of 3499, and certainly that's reflected in this report, is greater transparency. Because this report goes out to all the districts, and all the districts are required to post it on their web pages and have it at their school offices, as does ODE has it at on our website. So, you know, a parent, for example, could go into that and say, wait a minute, school district, why are you only spending 10% when the neighboring district is spending, let's say, 86% or 100% or whatever? But that was part of the rationale, part of the intent of 3499 is to shine a bright light on this kind of data.
And I think I know the answer, but do any districts decline the state school fund weight?
Representative Smith Warner, I know of no districts that do that. And I don't think I don't think they even have an option, right?
Okay.
Because it's just a formulaic weight, and so it just is the way that we calculate their, their check from the state school fund. Right.
Okay.
That's just like you're able to pay more taxes than you want, than you're required. You know that. How many people did that?
Representative Fernandez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Can you speak to how school districts do their accounting to determine how much they're spending on ELL students on the one hand, and on the other hand, you know, I've heard my school district say that there are things that they spend through other line items that they can't necessarily say it's for ELL students, but that should be accounted for. My fear and things that I've called out at school board budget meetings has been that we don't use things we're already spending money on to, and then classify them differently.
Mm-hmm. Chair Smith Warner, Representative Hernandez. So as part of the 3499 work, there was a work group on budget and accounting and reporting, because the concerns that you raised were definitely part of the concerns raised and why that one of the reasons the legislation passed. And so as part of that work group, the work group identified uniform accounting categories that school districts must report these expenditures in, and then those uniform categories go into something called PBAM, which I'm going to butcher what that stands for, but it's basically the Uniform Budget and Accounting Manual. And so then, by administrative rule, there's specific categories of how you can report services. But you're correct. So some of the things, an example of a category that perhaps folks struggle with in their reporting is language translation services. So I'll give that as an example, because our districts are expected, if there's a certain notice that goes out to a parent, that that notice is translated into other languages. That's not necessarily an English language learner service. So that's an example of something that under that uniform accounting, we would say, no, that does not count as an EL service. What the intent, though, of that is that some of those areas that a school district is now, when you go from district to district, it's an apples to apples comparison, that all the districts are reporting at least the same expenditures in the same way. So if District A is reporting a certain expenditure, you know, as an EL service, District B is as well. And then those other services that aren't really EL services are no longer in that category. And that's what I was referencing is when I said 14-15 data at, you know, that 86%, that was pre-3499. Those uniform budget and accounting standards went into effect January 1 of 2015. And so as the districts start to report, you know, that after that would be when those really started to apply.
Okay. And I'd just like to point out, Mr. Wilson was just pointing out to me that there is a link in the materials that has each district and their numbers, both by district, also kind of arrayed on a chart. And he was showing me the list because, again, on the chart, I'm always struck by it's one thing to know how many districts are doing something, but it's that whole thing of, you know, one district can be PPS, which is 47,000 kids, or it can be, you know, someone that has 47 students. So, Representative Fernandez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This is more of a comment, and I really appreciate the work of Representative Wisnant and Representative Joe Gallegos. Can't imagine all the inequities that have happened in the state in terms of ELL funding and school districts using those resources for different or other means instead of focusing. One of the reasons why I ran for the school board originally was because of the lack of accountability for our ELL students and a huge number of parents who didn't want their kids in ELL because they knew that it was meant for their kids to fail and not actually succeed. And I hope that that kind of cultural norm shifts into trusting this program. But I just wanted to comment, and hopefully we could do more to repair the historical inequity that this system has created.
Thank you.
Our next slide is another map. And so this is a map of under the state school fund, which school districts are receiving those EL weighted funds. Okay. And so you can see under this, you know, the red is those that are receiving the funds and the gray are school districts that are not receiving the funds. Okay. So now we're going to shift to 3499, although we've mentioned it quite a bit. And 3499 was adopted by the 2015 legislature. It was historic in that it's probably the first time that the Oregon legislature chose to appropriate and dedicate a specific amount of money to serve our EL students, you know, with requirements attached, okay? And so the amount of money that it established was a $12.5 million carve-out from the state school fund, and that's ongoing. And so for the 17-19 biennium, it will also be $12.5 million, you know, unless the law changes. And the intent of 3499, we've talked a little bit about this, but the first thing was to help districts and educators implement identified best practices. The piece of legislation had specific best practices listed in it, and so with those, you'll see those reflected on the department's webpage, for example, with resources for districts, and also embedded into the state EL plan and our work with the districts that are in improvement. The second thing was that 3499 established for the first time in state law a statewide EL plan. And I say for the first time in state law because 3 or 4 years ago we had a state EL plan that we did, but it wasn't established in state law. So then that plan has now been updated to reflect, you know, the work of 3499 and other measures.
And that's the 2013 plan that was referenced at the beginning of the presentation.
Correct. The third thing that 3499 did, we've referenced this as well, is it improved transparency, right? So it improved transparency in district reporting of data relating to allocations for students, expenditures, and those are some of the numbers that I was using earlier, but also demographics and educational progress. And what I referenced there is that there is the annual report, you know, that has this information in it, that districts are more fully required to report those budget and accounting codes that we talked about earlier. And then this is reported out in a format that parents can understand. Because as I started this presentation, I said there's, you know, these different programs and they kind of come together. So the annual report is meant to be digestible, okay, and pull all that data together. What was interesting is we started to implement 3499 and that annual report. Originally, it was the school districts are going to send ODE all this data. Well, we looked at it, we said, wait a minute, we have all this data. We don't need to burden districts again, you know, with another mandated report. So thank you, Oregon legislature. You changed that in 2016. So now it's just ODE pulls the data from our existing resources, and then we send it out in a usable format. So the fourth thing is it required us to identify a group of districts for 4 years and provide supports and progressive interventions to those districts. And I'm going to focus a lot of the remaining presentation on that work because that was the bulk of the money, where the money goes to under 3499. So, but of the $12.5 million, about $10.4 million is sent out to grants. And it says to 84 school districts. That's a greater number than the number of districts that were identified as transformation and target. And the reason for that is we also sent out some money to the education service districts to provide technical assistance, especially to those school districts that had a few number of English language learners. And the reason for that is that our bigger districts have experts who are on English learners. Our small districts, from year to year, they may or may not have an English learner. So we felt like they needed technical assistance from another source. And so that's the reason for that.
And will those resources in those ESDs for those small districts, one might assume those will continue to be there going forward?
Chair
so we
Smith
won't have Warner, to recreate that, maybe?
No, we believe they will be.
Okay, great. Okay. And I'd also just like to point out that since the state school fund weighted number was about 50,000, so this looks like it's targeting about half of those that are in underperforming, in districts where they are, those kids are underperforming compared to other districts that are doing ELL.
Correct. Chair Smith-Warner, that's correct. But I do want to point out that the state EL plan is meant to address all EL students. Sure. And some of the other, like the best practices, for example, that were embedded in 3499 and the transparency was meant to address all EL students.
So it's the big picture planning and at the same time targeting some of these significantly underperforming districts with high numbers of students, of ELL students. And each of them, you said, were identified for a 4 year?
4 years.
Okay. And are we going to, do you re-identify each year at the end of the 4 years?
So, Chair Smith-Warner, so the first group was identified for 4 years. So then at the end of the 4 years, assuming no changes in law, money, et cetera, we would identify another cohort.
Okay. Yeah.
So now getting into a little deeper, you know, into those districts. So we identified two categories of districts, and those were transformation districts and target districts. And transformation districts require more support. Their student progress indicators are lower generally than target districts, for example. And then, and they get more intensive sort of assistance. And then I already mentioned the technical assistance and the ESD support. Districts are identified for 4 years, and that's by state law. So even if a district shows remarked improvement in the first year, they're still identified for 4 years. And then this is very important. So after 4 years, if a district has not shown improvement, what 3499 says to the department is that department, you may direct how that district will expend all those monies they get under the 0.5 weight from, you know, the state school fund. So there is a huge incentive, right, for these districts to improve during that four-year time period. And ODE is allowed to do that for, I believe it's 2 years under 3499 after, you know, after the first 4 years. So it's those 2 years, right? So that also is historic because, like I said before, we have not previously had that ability. Okay. So now I'm going to get into how the districts were selected. And so the first thing we looked at is that a district has to have 20 or more EL students. This was for a continuity of data and also wanting to serve, you know, the greatest number of students, you know, with the money available. We also selected districts based on the first thing we looked at was student progress indicators or outcomes. And examples of those that we looked at were things like the five-year cohort graduation rate for both current EL students and those former EL students. Academic growth of current and former EL students in grades 6, 7, and 8. The growth in language acquisition specifically of current EL students in grades 1 through 8 as measured by ELPA. The growth in language acquisition of current EL students in grades 10 through 12 specifically. And then also the percentage of former EL students who enroll in a post-secondary institution after graduating. And then we also, though, the bill also directed us to look at the demographics of students and the needs of the district specifically. And so to determine needs, we looked at things like the percentage of current and former EL students as a percent of all students in the district. Remember, I said it's not just about the numbers, it's also about the percent. Also, the percentage of all students in poverty for the district. The percentage of current and former EL students who are economically disadvantaged specifically. So the first measure was all students in poverty. The second was specifically EL students. And then also the percentage of students who are mobile, percentage of students who are homeless, migrant students, recent arrivers, and also the number of unique home languages that a district has. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we combined those factors. I'll show you a grid after this that where we how we did that. And then what we looked at is once we had the list of possible districts, we applied some other factors to that list, such as what was the data trend for the district? So if it had a general data, if it was kind of on the bubble and had a general data trend of going up, it wasn't as likely to be identified. We also looked at geographic diversity and size of districts to ensure that we had a diversity of districts named. Okay. So the grid that I have up here for you, this is one of the actual grids, you know, that we used as part of this selection. And so what we did, and I should say what one of our very expert researchers did, was he plotted going up the left-hand grid, the, you know, the outcomes, or rather, you know, things like graduation rate and, you know, language proficiency. And then we also plotted going down the right hand or to the right hand side, the needs index. So that was those student demographics that I talked about. And then what this grid represents is the intersection of those two. So each dot on that grid is a school district in Oregon. The bigger the dot, the more EL students the district had. So we started to look at it because remember, we were directed to combine looking at both outcomes and needs. So that grid that's in the lower right-hand corner those basically became our transformation and target districts. So the districts in orange are transformation districts. Those are those districts that require more supports, more interventions. The districts in red are our target districts. We find this grid system to be very fascinating, right? Because you'll start to notice some trends on here. And one of those trends is that, you know, if you're a district with few numbers of EL students, you know, and your outcomes aren't as high as other districts, you know, you're on that lower section, right? Even though perhaps demographically, you know, you don't have as high a need, right? Mm-hmm. But we also started to notice, you know, where the large districts tended to congregate as well. So this is, I thought, a really interesting sort of representation of the work.
Can I ask, if the upper right quadrant, I would argue that you have a couple districts in there who have really high needs and are doing a really great job. Mm-hmm. Are they being tapped for involvement, best practices, something like that?
Yeah,
program.
Yeah, Chair Smith Warner, we noticed that as well, and you know, and certainly we had representatives from some of those districts on some of our work groups and so forth, and that is definitely something that we had identified as part of the plan as well. You know, because there was definitely districts in each quadrant that are kind of similar to each other demographically, and that also becomes kind of interesting, mm-hmm. I think. So the other thing about this that I wanted to point
Senator
out,
Senator Roblin,
it's also clear from that. We have an awful lot of districts that have high need. I mean, the part that's not need those are much smaller districts and mm-hmm. not very many big ones. When over on the need side, so which says we're a poor yeah. or other kinds of issues that cause high need, our whole state is moving in that direction, which is
yeah.
a little scary.
Unfortunate. Thing. Yeah, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and going on Senator Roblin's comments. One of the things I kept trying to input is that these grants, and I'm going to ask that maybe, can we get a one summary or one sentence of what the grants, you know, what, why they were, you know, how they were issued and all that or something? Because one of the things that I'm really concerned, and I think the small schools could benefit by this, is contracting for online services. That you do on your own, that you know, are based upon competency, not you know, a school year or school time. You know, we had a higher education thing that we're pushing for higher education to look at competency learning. It's the movement about through all education is competency, not doing within a certain time that the curriculum and the time school year dictates. And I think for the small schools, I hope that some of I talked to the doctor about this. I hope some of them are looking at using technology and not just saying we're going to train our teachers better to do this. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can comment on where any of the grants were issued that people are going to use technology versus.
Yeah. Chair Smith Warner, Representative Wisnett, that is certainly allowed under the grant as an expenditure. I think we'd have to get back to you specifically on, you know, whether the districts are using, you know, their funds on technology versus other services, but is definitely allowable.
Yeah. Yeah. And Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wisnett, we've actually brought some resources forward and provided exposure to the various resources and technologies and other materials that are available for districts to use and encourage them to really think outside the box and not necessarily use the same strategies that they've adopted in the past. And we will continue to work with them on that, and we can get you some information mm-hmm. relative to the strategies and the materials that some of the districts have adopted.
Thank you very much.
It might be an interesting thing for particularly kids we're trying to exit out kind of at the top end to mm-hmm. give them the opportunity for that proficiency work to kind of perhaps get them out
State
more quickly.
State of Utah contracts out all their ELL.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, and one final comment about the grid. The other way we use this grid is you're seeing it exactly how it was used in that there's no district names on there because we all have preconceived notions of districts. And so we literally told our researchers, don't show us the names and we will pick. And then, you know, we did the first analysis and said, okay, do we have geographic diversity? We did. Mm-hmm. So I'll get to the map. Yeah. So this highlights that we had 15 of those transformation districts, and then 25 target districts, and then our transformation districts may receive up to $180,000 a year, and then the target districts get up to $90,000. They're both identified for 4 years, and they both have that the similar requirements, you know, after 4 years. And here's our map. So this is a map of our targeted and transformation districts and where they're at in the state. The red is those districts that were identified for 4 years. You can see that they are spread throughout the state. And, you know, there's a variety of sizes and so forth, you know, represented here as well.
Could we maybe get a version of this that has one color for transformation and one color for targeted, please?
Certainly.
Thanks.
Okay. So, like I said, these districts were named last summer, essentially. So it's a relatively new designation. And so the activities that I have listed on this slide are some of the activities that they have been doing for the 16-17 year. So we had staff people from the department that went out and met individually with each district to assist them in performing these activities. So the first thing was they conducted an in-depth root cause analysis of, you know, why their EL students, you know, had the student progress indicators that were indicated in our data. We provided them, though, with tools and supports, you know, for this work. We also collaborated to evaluate and prioritize their needs. And then they also submitted a system evaluation tool. And then finally, they submitted a detailed budget. So basically, they aligned, you know, what they were asking for in their budget based on their needs and their analysis of data relating to the EL students. So these are, this is the work that they've been doing over the course of the last 8 to 9 months.
And the system evaluation tool, that would be, okay, we're going to base our results on blank and figuring out what that was going to be, whether it's grades or how quickly kids are getting out. Is that what that would be,
yeah,
or something else?
Chair Smith Warner, it also looked at data. For example, you know, are the students, you know, doing well in a particular grade but then drop off? Mm-hmm. Do you have students, for example, that are some of those students that are in for 7 years, and why is that? And so it looked at those kinds of issues. It also looked from school to school, so because some of these are large school districts, you know, and is it, you know, one school in particular is the reason? You know, so there was all of that. And it kind of varied, like I said, because we have some really small districts that are identified and some really big districts. And so varied, you know, from district to district as well.
I may add to that, Cindy. Madam Co-Chair, part of that is also looking at the instructional model that they have, the program model. Is it ESOL? Is it sheltered? Is it dual language? Is it bilingual? Mm-hmm. It is also looking at the curriculum that they use and the delivery of that curriculum, the training for teachers, looking at additional tools such as technology to deliver instruction. We've encouraged them to do an in-depth analysis of what they currently do in the program. And I actually had a conversation with the superintendent that said to me, he was a little bit concerned about the department directing his funds 4 years from now. So I said to him, I said, well, take every step
Fix
you possibly can to avoid that, because we don't want to be directing your program 4 years from now. He said he wants, what he really wants to do is essentially transform his entire program. And I said, use the resources to do that. That's essentially what this is for you to examine what you currently do, look at what worked, what doesn't work, and do an in-depth analysis relative to staffing, program design, delivery, et cetera. So,
okay. Thank you. And, you know, and the other thing I should mention is that the districts that were identified, they didn't have an option of not being identified. Okay. I suppose they could have refused the funds, but they would have been held under the same standard in 4 years. Okay.
So, and we are at about 3 minutes out, and the co-chair and I have our meeting with the big chairs after. So I hate to push you, but
definitely wrap this up. And so we've already talked about the districts exiting after 4 years. It's not a one-size-fits-all. The districts worked with the department to identify those student progress indicators that are most pertinent to their success. So, for example, a district that saw that their issue was with their elementary grades would identify progress indicators that would measure elementary school success, versus a district that was focusing on high school might identify high school graduation rates. And then finally, to bring us back to what all these programs are intended to do is to improve achievement gaps that exist between our EL students and other students. So this is also 14-15 data, but it shows that our average graduation rate for the statewide five-year cohort graduation rate of current ELs was 61%. By comparison, for 14-15, for all students, the graduation rate in that year was 76.5. But the next slide is also very interesting.
Oh, I love this one.
This is the same year. And so this measures those former EL students. Remember, a student who at any point in their career received EL services, their grad rate was 80%.
So, almost 5 points higher than the statewide average.
And then finally, I've referenced this link a number of times. This is our annual report, you know, that we produced, as a result of 3499. And it has a tremendous amount of information in it. This was meant as almost an appetizer to that.
Great. Thank you, Cindy. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To all of you, I think the Department of Education did a great job. This is historical, and I think it's very important. I've always said that I think that this is affecting our total graduation dropout absentee rate. One thing that Representative Hernandez mentioned briefly, and that's been a concern of mine, and you can do this offline or give it to the whole committee, the fact of how you identify or put them in the EL program. I had parents sitting crying in my office saying, my son should never have been in ELL. He speaks English at home and he's very proficient. So if you can provide us some information, what you're doing to clean that up as far as not putting them in the ELL program, if the parents think that they're whatever. So, but thank you for all the work on this. I think it's going to really be important to the future of our success in high school graduation.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay. With that, we are adjourned. We'll see you. Our next meeting will be Monday, the 8th of May. And happy day before May the 4th.
So sad that you're not.
Happy day before May the 4th.
So sad that you're not.
Happy.